We looked yesterday at the Ionian philosophers, of whom there are four. There's actually more than that, but as a great mercy to you, I only want you to know four of them. All right? Thales, Anaximander, Anaximenes, and of course, in conclusion, the well-known Heraclitus. We shift gears today and we look at the other side, sandwiched Greece on the other end, and that's the Italian philosophers. So we have Ionian and Italian. The Italian philosophers were there. They're Greek, you see, but this was Greek migration that some of you were mentioning yesterday. I want you to learn a couple of technical terms. All of the Ionian philosophers were called corporeal monists. Corporeal monists. And you know enough to be able to parse that term right away. You know exactly what it would mean just by looking at it. You think, yeah, of course, it makes sense. In fact, I virtually thought of that myself when I was eating breakfast this morning. I thought, you know, hey, all of those Ionians, they were kind of like corporeal monists, right, Josiah? What's the meaning of that term, corporeal monist, you suppose? Go ahead, Josiah.
The only thing that's coming to mind is the word corpus means body.
Yes,
in Latin.
That's right.
So
exactly.
Corporeal, well, monist is... monist, we do that everything can be reduced down to one element.
Yes.
So...
That's not bad, though. That's very good. You're right. The word corpus means body, but it also has the idea simply of material. And so these are people who said everything can be reduced to one material element. Okay, does that make sense? For Thales, that one material element was what? Mr. Fugit?
Water.
Water. For Heraclitus, fire, which is not exactly corporeal, but he didn't know that. So, you get the idea. When we jump over to the Italians, they are also monists, but they're called in philosophy incorporeal monists. So they also believe everything can be reduced to one essence, but they don't think it makes sense that that one essence is material. They think it must be something more spiritual, non-material, non-corporeal, or incorporeal. So that's the term that's been used. All right, there's four of these guys as well. There's more, but again, as a mercy to you, I'm only going to require that you know four of them. The first one is one you've heard of. A guy by the name of Pythagoras, which I now realize I misspelled. I was suspicious I did that. Pythagoras, who lives 582 to 497. Second of them, Xenophanes. Again, I don't want you to know, you don't have to know all these dates. You may want to just write this down for future reference. His dates are 570 to 470. Lived to be 100 years old, or at least he lived to be pretty old. Third of these characters is named Parmenides. P-A-R-M-E-N-I-D-E-S, Parmenides, 510 to 450. And the last one, Zeno. ...490 to 430. The two whose dates I want you to know in this case are Pythagoras and Parmenides. So, let's talk about Pythagoras. You all have heard of Pythagoras, of course. He's most famous for, from your point of view, your educational experience, Mr. Haverkamp.
He's most famous for the Pythagorean
theorem. The Pythagorean theorem is absolutely correct, which is what? What is the Pythagorean theorem? You can just tick that off the top of your head. What is the Pythagorean theorem?
That's, if you have the two legs of the triangle, to find.
What kind of triangle? Yes, right, not wrong. Not a wrong triangle, a right triangle. Then what? Let's have the rest of it. What is it?
If you have two legs or two sides of a right triangle, you can find the third side.
Well, yes, that's right. That's right. That's right. And so the basic statement of the theorem is what? Go ahead, Spencer.
A squared plus b squared equals c squared.
That's right, exactly. A squared plus b squared equals c squared being the hypotenuse, right? And the other two being the legs of the right triangle. So, you may be interested in knowing that the character that we know of as Pythagoras did a whole lot more stuff besides figure out the Pythagorean theorem. But that's what we usually remember him for. So, just a few details about Pythagoras. He was born on an island off the Italian, off the Greek coast called Samos. But he lived for the most of his career in Italy. He moved there with the Greeks who were colonizing Italy. If you recall from Bible context, we talked about the period of Greek colonizing when they all were taking off for various parts of the world, and Pythagoras traveled with them to Italy. He was really into music, but he was into kind of the theory of music and especially harmonics. He was one of these guys that sat around with a string and noticed that if you plucked the string, it would vibrate, and if you shortened the length, the sound would get what? Higher or lower? Yet higher. And why is that, do you suppose? In terms of physics, why is it that as you make the string shorter, it gets higher?
Not in physics, but I think it has less area for the...
There's just less mass there, isn't it? So there's less to move and it vibrates at a higher rate. If you have a string, let's say we have a string that's 8 inches long, and I pluck the string, and I get a nice sound, bung. You like that? Nice. And then I lengthen the string to twice that, so now it's 8 plus 8, it's 16 inches long, and I pluck it, what am I going to get? Laura?
Much deeper.
How much deeper? Precisely how much deeper? An octave. So, if I start with, I'll go a little higher, bong, there's our sound, and then I lengthen the string, the next sound I'm going to get is going to be, you sing, what is it going to be? Can anybody sing it? That's right. Okay. And you notice how those two kind of sound alike, don't they? I mean, I'm not much of a singer, but you hear, you know, they sound kind of like the same note. Except they're an octave apart. We all understand that. And the reason we know is because... Thank you. And the reason is because the string is now vibrating at precisely half the speed that it was when it was half as long. Well, Pythagoras, you know, he just sat around thinking about this stuff all the time. He did not have a life. You know what I'm saying? This is all he did. He was fascinated with numbers. And that was to him, and this is important, he's an incorporeal monist. That is to say, the fundamental reality of things is not material. It is spiritual. And for him, that spiritual reality was in numbers. Mathematics. is the deep reality. It's not water, as Thales said, or fire, as Heraclitus. It's numbers. And he believed that numbers were the basic rational principle behind all things. And then he made a very alarming discovery, a discovery that was so disturbing to him that one of the rules he imposed on his disciples was if this secret was ever disclosed by any of them, that person would be punished by death. He made an alarming discovery about numbers. Anybody have any idea? What did he discover about numbers that was so embarrassing to him, so troubling to him, that he thought it was a dark secret? He didn't even want people to learn about it when he first discovered it. And then he swore his disciples to secrecy that they would never disclose it. And Matthew, that dark secret about numbers that he discovered was that there was such a thing as
zero.
No, he didn't have a problem with zero. He had a problem with...
Is it infinity?
Not infinity, but you're awfully close. He had a problem with irrational numbers. I mean, that's scary. Don't you agree? Irrational numbers. Kind of makes a chill run down your spine, doesn't it? That the square root of 2 never comes out even. You know, he was kind of, I think he was basically OCD. He had all kinds of very strange rules. He said if you got up in the morning on one side of the bed, you had to get back in on the other side of the bed. But these all had to do with some kind of cult of mathematics. And he was trying to maintain a sort of symmetry and precision, you know, about his experience. So anyway, he founded a cult. It was kind of a weird cult. We're not too interested in it. But he did develop some principles. I do want you to know these. So the main things from Pythagoras I want you to know. These were big influences on Plato. And so it's three things that I want you to know that were actually developed by Pythagoras that deeply affected Plato. They became part of Plato's outlook. One, it's called the body-soul dualism. We have a body, we have a soul, he affirmed that. Unlike the Ionians who said we only have body, right? We have a soul. What's the relationship between body and soul? How would you describe it? If we use the term dualism, it means, Spencer?
Well, they're together in here, but they're not the same.
They're together, they are not the same thing. It's a little more than that. It is, Sarah? They're in conflict. The word dualism virtually always implies conflict. There's two English words, duality or dual, and dualism. Dual just means two-ness, you know. So you have two people get married. You've got a mommy and a daddy, husband and wife, etc. We hope that they live in a kind of duality. We hope they do not live in a dualism. Okay, you get the difference? We hope that they get along, that they're happy, that it's a pleasant relationship. But if it's a dualism, it means they are in conflict. They're in war, and usually implies a kind of irreconcilable conflict. For Pythagoras, your body and your soul are in a constant struggle. Which side of that struggle do you think stands for virtue? Where would virtue be found? Ben, where do you think? In the body or the soul?
In the soul.
In the soul. The body is the place where evil impulses are located. And it's in conflict with the soul, which is the higher part, right? And Plato picked that up. That became part of Plato's philosophy. Second thing from Pythagoras, he made famous the notion of, he probably did not invent it, but he certainly emphasized it, reincarnation. What religion is famous for believing in reincarnation? Do you know? Eastern religion? Anybody know? No? Jordan?
Buddhism?
Well, Buddhism, maybe some Buddhists do. It's not as conspicuous in Buddhism as it is in, Megan, Hinduism, right? And it is the belief, what? Reincarnation. We live multiple lives. You die, you come back. Usually associated with it is something the Hindus call karma, which is if you lived a good life, you're going to come back in a better situation. If you lived a bad life, you're going to come back in a not so good situation, kind of a balance of things. Ultimately, the purpose of existence is not to sort of keep coming back again and again. The purpose is to escape from that wheel. There you are. And the third one is called the immortality of the soul. So immortality of the soul would be what? There's a kind of indestructibility about it, keeps going. So those three ideas are picked up by Plato. And I'm going to leave Pythagoras at that point. That's about as much as we need to know. The next guy is Xenophanes. Xenophanes is important, but not important enough for us to spend a lot of time on him. But one thing that makes him interesting is that he is a great attacker of the Greek gods. He does not believe in the gods. He believes in a god. He is monotheistic. And he pokes a lot of fun at the Greek gods. And he makes a famous statement, which sounds a little bit like the Bible, but not quite. And the statement that he makes is, we create the gods in our own image. Right? We create the gods in our own image. So he says, you know, if we were birds, our gods would have wings. If we are Native Americans, our gods carry bows and arrows. I mean, you get the idea. We create the gods in our own image. There's another philosopher much later in history who, without giving any credit to Xenophanes for it, repeated that. And it's become a famous phrase much more recently. So you may want to note this down, and when we reach this guy later in this course, I will remind you that I mentioned this to you way back when. And the guy's name is Ludwig Feuerbach, F-E-U-E-R-B-A-C-H. And he also said the same thing, but he's a 19th century philosopher, so we won't worry about him right now. All right, probably the most important of these, the fellow who is the answer to Heraclitus. The one that we want to understand most is Parmenides. Parmenides believes that this whole perception of a universe of change must be illusory. It is irrational. And so he famously says, the most famous phrase that comes from Parmenides, the one that you want to remember and carry with you for the rest of your life, the insight is so profound. Three little words, whatever is, is. Whatever is, is. Corollary, all else is illusory. There is this fundamental level of reality that he calls being, and that is what is real. And everything that you think you see in this world around you that seems to be changing is just pure illusion. It's not there. Because change itself is irrational. He wrote two great works. We don't have either of them. We just have allusions to them through Aristotle. One is called The Way of Truth, and the other is The Way of Seeming. The way of truth is this affirmation of this fundamental reality of being. The way of seeming is the way of appearances, where we think we see things that aren't there. All right. Now, Parmenides was profound, persuasive, but almost incomprehensible. But there was a guy that came after him named Zeno, who was something like an apologist, a popularizer of Parmenides. He was a younger man, he was the next generation, but he followed Parmenides around and sort of explained him to people and made it comprehensible, if that was possible, what Parmenides was saying. And one of the ways that he did this was by a bunch of paradoxes, and these have come to be called Zeno's paradoxes. All right? Have you ever heard of Zeno's paradoxes? Anybody ever heard that expression? Zeno's paradoxes. The first time I ever encountered these, it made me wonder about myself, because it reminded me of something that had bothered me when I was a little kid. And I don't know if any of you will identify with this, but you will probably detect as I describe it to you what a very strange child I was. So that while other kids were out playing baseball and doing normal stuff, I'm sitting in the house worrying about these things, you know. And I remember having a little toy truck, I think it was a little dump truck, and sitting in my living room and thinking, as I was sitting maybe 8 feet from the wall of this living room, about this dump truck I had, about pushing the dump truck toward the wall. I was probably 8 years old, I would say. And I was thinking to myself, you know, theoretically, I could push the dump truck toward the wall and never get there. I know. Now, does anybody know what was in my 8-year-old brain that would have made me think that I can push the dump truck toward the wall and never get there? What was I thinking?
You could keep pushing it, but
yes, that's the idea. That's what I was thinking. The way I conceived of it was this. I was thinking, well, I could push my dump truck halfway to the wall, and then I could push my dump truck half of that distance, and then I could push my dump truck half of that distance. I actually tried this as an experiment, and I kept doing it. And theoretically, do you realize, I could spend the rest of eternity pushing my dump truck halfway of the remaining distance. In no matter how small a distance I conceived of, I could imagine half of that. If it was any distance at all, you can always imagine half of it, can't you? And so at least in theory, I could keep doing that forever. And that did drive me crazy. Hence, here I am. Now, that was, and I have eventually decided, well, on the other hand, and I just pushed my dump truck to the wall, and it hit the wall, so I knew somehow or other I was overruling that kind of, but it did trouble me, and then I didn't think much more about it until years later when I was a philosophy minor at Whitworth, and I came across a guy named Zeno. Now, Zeno did not have a dump truck paradox, you know, but he had several that were of the same general species. So here they are. There's three of these paradoxes of Zeno. And I'll give them to you in order of my preference of them. So the first of them is the paradox of the runner. The paradox of the runner. The second one is the paradox of the tortoise and the hare. Although you'll sometimes hear it, Achilles and the tortoise. So it comes in two different little flavors, and either one will make the same point. And the third one is the paradox of the arrow. The arrow. Now, remember what Zeno is attempting to accomplish, he's wanting to prove that Parmenides is correct. And what you need to keep in mind from Parmenides is this. Parmenides believes that the ideas of space and time, and therefore the ideas of time and motion, are absurd. That there cannot be space, motion, time. All of these things are illusory. whatever is, but whatever is a fixed and eternal, unchanging reality known as being. And if I think things are changing around me, then I'm simply deceived. I'm living in an illusion. Zeno was trying to prove the truth of that. So the first illustration he gives of this is the paradox of the runner. The idea here, and it's kind of like my dump truck, except it's just the opposite. Zeno put it this way. Before the runner can run 100 yards, he has to run how many yards? Well, yeah, we'll go by halves here. You're right, but it would take a lot longer to do it your way. So we'll go by, 50. But before he can run 50, he's got to run 25. But then before he can do that, he's got to run 12 and a half. And you know how that works. And no matter how far he has to run, before he can run that distance, he has to run half that distance. And the distance he has to run, therefore, is infinitely divisible, so that ultimately he cannot run at all. Because no matter where, how much he's going to run, he's got to run half of that distance first, you see. So before he can even run 1 inch, he's got to run a half an inch. But before he can run a half an inch, he's got to run a quarter of an inch. And it just keeps narrowing down to where you realize he cannot move. That the runner is an illusion. So that's his first paradox. His second paradox is the Achilles and the hare. Achilles and the tortoise, or sometimes called the tortoise and the hare. Either way. And this he envisions as kind of a race. So we're out on the track. And here's the race. And of course, as between a hare and a tortoise, who's faster? Not a trick question, Krista. The hare, so we're going to put the bunny over here. Big ears there, legs, head, nose. And we're going to put the tortoise, it's scary to try to dry this one, but here's the head. That's not actually too bad, you know? All right. So the way that the reasoning goes is that the hare has to catch up with the tortoise. So the hare scampers down and gets to where the tortoise was, but of course in the meantime the tortoise has made a little bit of progress, hasn't he? So then the hare has to get up to where the tortoise was there, but the tortoise has made a little bit of progress. And no matter how fast the hare runs, he can never quite get to where the tortoise actually is, because he's always having to get to where he was. And the tortoise has always, in the meantime, made a little bit of progress. And so there's an infinite number of divisions that finally prevents the hare from ever catching the tortoise. You kind of get the feel for that. Now I want to give you one more, and then we'll talk about it, see what you think of it. The third of his paradoxes is the paradox of the arrow. So here we have, you're standing outside, and whoosh, an arrow goes flying beside, hopefully it doesn't hit you, but it goes flying by. There's its feathers back there. We'll show, this is speed, that's what I'm indicating there. There's the arrow flying through the air. Zeno says, of course, the arrow is not moving. It cannot move. Because you think, okay, what is the, you can think about how much distance does the arrow cover in one, let's say, second. And depending on the speed at which it's going, we might say, well, it covers so many yards or so many feet, in a second. Then you say, well, how much distance does it cover in half a second? Or in a quarter of a second? Or in an eighth of a second? And you keep, what is the very tiniest particle of time? Pardon me? a nanosecond, but can you think of a half a nanosecond? A nanosecond is an amount of time. You know, computers operate it in terms of but you can think of half a nanosecond. What's the very tiniest particle of time? What is all time made up of? The tiniest particle of time is A. We call it A. What? An instant, similar word, but a better word. Say it. Moment. How long is a moment? It has no. A moment is to time what a mathematical point is to space, right? You know that in geometry, for example, a mathematical point takes up how much space? None. It's infinitely small. It's a point. And yet, a circle is made up of an infinite number of what? Points. None of which takes up any space. You with me? A moment is similar to time. All time is made up of moments, but a moment has no duration. It's an infinitely small little particle of time. How much distance does the arrow cover in one moment? How much distance does it cover, Josiah? In one moment, the arrow covers how much distance? None. In that moment, it is at rest. And therefore, because the arrow is always existing in a moment, the arrow is always at rest. It is not moving. It cannot move because it is always existing in a moment. There have been all kinds of attempts to answer Zeno's paradoxes. Believe me, people have looked at them and thought, well, they're amusing, they're interesting, they're kind of perplexing. There have been attempts to answer, but I think people who look at it honestly say that in the final analysis, it's very difficult to give an answer. We, of course, take it for granted that there's motion because I can walk over and slap Trevor and he can feel it, and so he has an empirical experience that tells him there was indeed motion. But in terms of pure rationality, not what I perceive but what I actually am led to by the operation of reason, I have to say motion doesn't make a lot of sense. It is a somewhat absurd idea. And that's why Parmenides wound up saying, you know, we think we see motion, but in fact, it cannot be because it is absurd. Okay. So that's kind of whatever is, is. But all these things we think we experience are irrational. Go ahead.
Did he have an alternative to motion?
Yeah.
Or
Just that these are illusion. He's not denying that we experience something that's called motion, but that it's simply an illusory experience. It's like a hallucination.
So then would everything we do have to be illusion?
Yes, yes. Everything we do.
Okay.
We are, but in terms of being, we are simply part of that greater being. And that is the fundamental reality. And of course, that being is not exactly corporeal. I erased it, but these are incorporeal monists. Being is not matter. It is something deeper. Matter, you see, again, implies motion, implies time, and so on. So it's something deeper than that. Now, that may strike you as kind of bizarre, and that's fine, but these ideas were very, very influential on Plato. Plato picked up this thought of Parmenides, but he also appreciated Heraclitus, and he tried to figure out a way to synthesize these two. He tried to figure out a way to take a little bit of both and produce a philosophy that would account for both of them. But we are going to save that for a later